To Matthew chapter 19. It's good to be with you and involved in this project of going through the Bible. I had a short week this week because I am not taking my normal Thursday off because Wise Guys is beginning again. So I took Monday off, and Tuesday when I popped in here and I looked at the text that was our next text, Matthew 19 verses 1 and forward, I gave serious thought to bypassing it altogether. I know. Thank you. That's the right response. That's the right and righteous response. I was looking at it. The lectionary just bypasses chapter 19 altogether. It doesn't care to ever cover it within the church year. And it's a difficult text. And I thought, what am I going to say about this very challenging text over a controversy regarding divorce and remarriage? And then I finally thought, you know, when we get to Mark, Luke, and John, because there are three other Gospels, we're not going to spend 2 years in each of them like we have, it looks like we're going to be in Matthew. We'll go through them at a much brisker pace because we've covered some of this stuff already in Matthew, and plus, we just don't need to rehash the story four times through. But I figure we have done so far with Matthew every single passage. We haven't bypassed anything. We've gone through everything in it. And one of the challenges that I don't think the lectionary helps us with at times is forcing us to go through difficult passages, passages that are easier to skip or to look over. And I have found in studying this the last 2 days that I'm glad I'm going through this. I hope it will be helpful to some of you, perhaps all of us. I hope it will remind us of how Jesus is coming at the scriptures over some very controversial and challenging issues in his own day, and even in our own day. So, we're ending chapter 18. And, of course, Matthew is shaped after five extended discourses, which are patterned after the five books of the law. We just finished chapter 18, which is all about instruction to the kingdom. And we are now moving into the final days for Jesus. And we see it in Matthew 19, verse 1. He's on a journey now from Galilee in the north to his eventual end in Judea. So when Jesus had finished saying these things, and that's the phrase that's always found after one of these main discourses is ended, he left Galilee, we're done with Galilee, that's been the bulk of his ministry, and went into the region of Judea to the other side of the Jordan. Large crowds followed him, and he healed them there. So this is the beginning of the death march, the beginning of the end. Jesus is moving into Jerusalem, and that will be his end. He will finally come to a cross, and between now and then, all kinds of controversies are going to arise, which lead to that final conflict. And one of the biggest controversies is raised by the Pharisees in regard to a very hot-button issue of their day. Verse 3, some Pharisees came to test him. And that, of course, is the first word you need to hear to know they are not asking a serious question because they don't want an honest answer. They're coming to trip him up. It's a gotcha question. They're trying to stump him, at the very least, create a matter of dispute so that people look at him with less confidence. At the very most, they'd like to completely get him off the track of being popular with the people. And so they're hoping to stump him and make him to appear to be something that he's not. And so they ask this gotcha question. Is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife, and here's the key phrase, for any and every reason? And in asking for any and every reason, they are leaving the path open for him to either agree or disagree with a couple of major schools of thought in Jesus' day. There were a number of schools of thought, but the two largest schools was one, the school of Hillel, which was the more liberal side of things. And Hillel said, you can divorce for any cause. He's the one that's famously known for saying, even if your wife burns the toast, that's legitimate cause to divorce your wife. Then you had the school of Shammai, a little bit more conservative, who said that you can divorce for unfaithfulness, but what he means here is not necessarily adultery. What he means here is just any indecency, anything that makes it seem like you're not a lawful and just person. And so that's the key phrase. They're trying to get Jesus to either take sides and then cause those who don't hold that position to be very offended, or they're trying to cause him to come up with a new position, but either way, they want to test him. So, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any and every reason? Jesus responds by saying, let's talk about law, and let's talk about the time before the law. Because there was a time before the law was given, Genesis 1, 2, and 3, and forward, where there's no law, Moses doesn't exist, and yet there are good and righteous things that God has created, and those good things are a model and a pattern for how life should be, even before the law is given. When they raise this controversy, they're referring to a passage we'll look at in a moment that's Deuteronomy 24. In verse 8 is where Jesus begins to explicate what's going on in Deuteronomy 24. So they're dealing with the law, book 5 of the Torah. Jesus wants to take them to book 1. And so he says in verse 4, "Haven't you read," he replied, "that at the beginning the Creator made them male and female and said, 'For this reason a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh.'" That's Genesis 2. "So they are no longer two, but one. Therefore, what God has joined together, let not man separate." So Jesus comes to this creation, this sense of how things were before this law was given. Deuteronomy 24 comes 5 books later, and the law that the Pharisees are referring to is, if a man marries a woman who becomes displeasing to him because he finds something indecent about her, he can write her a certificate of divorce. That's part of the law. It's a legitimate aspect of the law. And if you notice, what Hillel tended to do was to focus on that word. If your spouse does something that's displeasing to you, burning your toast, that brings certain displeasure because I guess you were expecting a wonderfully cooked piece of toast. Ruining your dish, finding a prettier woman, things like being unable to bear children, anything that would displease would be what Hillel would say. And for him, that includes a whole lot of things. You then can notice that Shammai actually focused on this word, indecent. So there are two words here. The woman becomes displeasing, or he finds indecent. For Hillel, he could open the floodgates by saying, well, anything can displease you. Shammai was more conservative and said, no, it has to be something indecent. It's something shameful or repulsive. And in that day, it meant conversing with men, or showing your arms and spinning them in public, or loosening your hair in public, or just any deliberate transgression of the law. So we're living in a different world. But in that world, those things would show some looseness and some lack of commitment in a marriage. If you will notice, neither Deuteronomy 24 nor Hillel or Shammai ever mention adultery. And the reason's quite simple. You know what the law's penalty for adultery is, don't you? Stoning. So they don't ever give that, because it's assumed if adultery happens, then the marriage is over. So that's never on their list of what are the legitimate reasons for marriage, because that's not even on the page. It's not even in the discussion. So Jesus now is stuck in between a rock and a hard place. Who is he going to agree with, or is he going to move to a different place? And as Jesus often does, he's going to move to a different place, and it's going to bring some controversy. We see in verses 4 and 5, he goes back, and I love how in verse 4 he begins in a way that's very cheeky. "Haven't you read?" That's quite a thing to say to a theologian or a professor or a scholar. "Didn't you read your own book?" I mean, there is something cheeky about that, and he loves to say that, and he says it over and over in Matthew particularly. "Haven't you read? Aren't you familiar with your sacred scriptures? And if you go to your scriptures, you will find that there is this place before the law. And before any law is ever given, there is a natural order of things that is good and wholesome and right. And one of those things is marriage, where a man leaves his father and mother, he's united. The two become one, and there is a bond that is greater than any other bond that we know of in human relationships. It is a bond of leaving and cleaving and becoming one. And Jesus sees that because it's given in a state of sinlessness. When everything is good before there is the temptation and the fall and other such things, he sees that as the pattern for how things should be. Then the Pharisees get cheeky themselves in verse 7. "Why then," they asked, "did Moses command that a man give his wife a certificate of divorce and send her away?" Why did God allow Moses to write Deuteronomy 24:1. And that's a pretty good response. They say, okay, we're familiar with the beginning of the book, but why therefore is there this law within the Torah that gives us permission to divorce? And Jesus' answer is wonderful. Verse 8, Jesus replied, Moses permitted. Now you see how the language has changed? In verse 7, why did Moses command? And for the Pharisees, this becomes a command on par with love God with all your heart, soul, strength, and mind. Love your neighbor as yourself. Do justice. Walk humbly. Divorce your wife if she displeases you. It just is in that same category of these are things that we must do. But Jesus moves the discussion in a different direction because he's now looking at it from the stance of original goodness. And he says, Moses permitted you to divorce your wives. Why? Because your hearts were hard. But it was not this way from the beginning. Jesus wants to say there's this thing that has been introduced into God's good creation called sin. And the consequence of sin is a hardness of heart. A stance that one has within themselves that's opposed to God's good and righteous way. So that God, knowing that we have fallen and we're in need of regulation of our behavior, has given the law. But the law doesn't command divorce. It merely acknowledges its existence and seeks to regulate it. It wants to give some kind of direction to a reality that exists because of sin. Just like the law gives direction and regulation in realities that God never commanded. Slavery is never commanded in the Scripture. But it's a reality in the ancient world. And so God gives laws to regulate it. And if you read those laws, they usually have a lot to do with showing dignity and humanity to others. God never gives a command, marry bundles of wives. Just polygamy yourself to death. There's never a command for polygamy. And yet there are commands to regulate it. Because it exists. Why does it exist? Because of the hardness of human hearts. It's not a command, it's a concession. God permits it because of the realities that we all face in a world wrought with sin, but it's not God's original intention. And when you begin to think of commands that way, you realize almost every command exists because of human sin. They almost are all there to regulate our perverse, twisted, wayward, hard-hearted behavior, to make it so that the evil we do isn't quite as harmful as it could be if it wasn't regulated in some way. So that you have this real sense in Jesus' mind that the law of God comes back to taking second place to God's original creation ordinances. To the way God designed the world to be. A way that's been broken through human hardness of heart and sin, but a way that remains good and remains the standard for human behavior. So God's original intention is not always found in law as much as it's found in looking at those first few chapters of Genesis and considering, how is this world really meant to work? How are relations really meant to function? What is it meant to really have meaningful labor and a meaningful Sabbath? All these things that are part of God's created order before any law comes into place. So with that said, Jesus then gives them the only reason he will give for divorce. Verse 9, I tell you that anyone who divorces his wife, and here's the exception clause, except for marital unfaithfulness, the Greek word is porneia, which means all manners of sexual immorality, and marries another woman, commits adultery. Now let me read that for you one more time, because that's very important that we hear the clear grammar of this. I tell you that anyone who divorces his wife, with one exception, except for marital unfaithfulness, and marries another woman, commits adultery. Now that's not all the Bible has to say about marriage. So don't start throwing stones at Jesus. But it is to say that he's not going to side with Hillel, and he's not going to side with Shammai. He's going to say that there is this thing called adultery, which in the law of Moses commanded stoning. But now that's the reason that he's going to give to break a marriage, to cause and allow for there to be a legitimate divorce. Paul later, and when we get to 1 Corinthians 7 in 2019 or 20 or 21 or 22, all depends on the pace we go. When we finally get there, Paul's going to have a different situation because Jesus is addressing people who all share the same religion for the most part. They share the same culture, the same religion. Paul is confronted with a world where pagans are marrying believers, and some are Jews and some are Gentiles, and there's a much more challenging commitment involved there. And he will actually argue in 1 Corinthians 7, if you're married to someone and they don't want to stay with you and they desert or abandon their marital commitment, then let them go. You're not under duress for that. So he's going to actually give an additional reason, which many people call desertion. You could call it abandonment. It is where one partner is unwilling to fulfill the responsibilities of their marital vow. The bottom line, when you put all that together with both Paul and Jesus, is although both participants in a marriage are responsible for it, one person can't save a marriage alone. And one person can irreparably harm a marriage to the point where it can't go on. Because marriage is a two-way street. It always demands a two-way commitment to covenant fidelity. So that one person can't save it alone, and if they can't, Paul says, let them go, if that's where they're going to go. And one person, through adultery and other things, can irreparably harm a marriage. So my favorite summary of what Jesus has to say here is found from Craig Keener, and he puts it this way: divorce is an evil to be avoided at all cost, even a divorce that fits into those exceptions. A divorce that is permissible is still a very painful loss. It's a painful thing for anyone involved. Nobody gets married thinking, hey, this is going to fail. Nobody does that. And so it's always an evil to be avoided at any cost. And only when the salvation of the marriage is truly impossible is it valid. And the salvation of the marriage is impossible only if one party in the marriage has unilaterally decided to end it by seeking to leave or by acting adulterously. In such a case, divorce is the formal declaration of what is already true in fact: the marriage is broken and the guilty party is responsible for it. I think that's a fantastic summary of what Paul and Jesus have to contribute to this issue of divorce and remarriage. Which then brings you, because this should on the surface sound very challenging and hard, because the disciples hear it that way. Verse 10, the disciples said to him, if this is the situation between a husband and a wife, it's better not to marry. Those guys are thinking, you know, if you are taking this ultimate risk and entering into a situation where there are very few escape clauses, then it's better to just not take the risk at all. And I think that they have their finger on something, because we all know this, and this is where we want to show as much sympathy and compassion as possible. Life in a fallen world means the best intentions can still result in miserable failure. Just because you enter into a relationship with this hopeful intention doesn't mean it can't end horribly. No one, I don't think I've ever married any couple, and I've married 100 plus. I've done a lot of marriages. I was a singles pastor for 10 and a half years. I've done a number of them here. I don't think I've ever married anyone where they were entering the marriage planning on divorcing. I've never done a prenuptial agreement. I've never had anyone think, hey, this is going to fail. And yet I can tell you I've done enough of them to see some fail, and to see their hopes shattered by the realities of how challenging it is to have the two become one flesh. It is such a challenge that only someone who's never married can actually entertain illusions that marriage is easy. When you say, till death do us part, you're actually saying, this thing's going to kill me. You are admitting that. Rita Rudner says, I love being married. It's so great to find that one special person that you can annoy for the rest of your life. Billy Graham was once asked, what's the secret of your 54-year marriage to Ruth? And this was at that time. They've been married longer now. And he said, Ruth and I are happily incompatible. There's a joke that I have to tell here of a couple that was married for 60 years, an old couple, and the old man says to his wife, he says, I admire you. And she says, what? He says, I admire you. And she says, speak up, I can't hear that well, you know that. And he says, almost screaming, "I admire you." And she says, "That's okay. I'm tired of you too." It's a challenge. I think that's why Matthew has placed his treatment of divorce and remarriage after the parable of the unmerciful servant. The parable that invites God's people to show 77 forgiveness, or 70 times 7. To know that a big part of being in a healthy, robust relationship where you're committed to one another is learning that fine art of forgiveness and demonstrating the fidelity that only comes about through hard knocks and the trials of life. And so the disciples recognize this. They see how hard this is, and they say, maybe it's better not to marry. And at this time, some of them already are married. Jesus replies in verse 11, "Not everyone can accept this word, but only those for whom it is given," which is to say, some are called to singleness. Some can live this, and Paul will actually say he has the gift of singleness. Timothy was single, Jesus was single, Jeremiah was single. You can go through a list of people in the scriptures who are single, but they are few and far between. Most are married, because in Jewish culture, you would seem to be a very odd duck not to be perpetuating your line and becoming married and having a family. It would seem very odd. But Jesus is actually saying here, it is hard, but most people can't do it. It takes a special gift. And then he talks about those who have this gift for various reasons. Verse 12, "For some are eunuchs because they were born that way." In other words, they are celibate because they simply can't have sexual union. "Others were made that way by men," and that would be those who are castrated, that oftentimes were in charge of a king's harem or concubines, and this would make sure that they didn't mess with the harem or the concubines. "And others have renounced marriage." Others have simply chosen to do this because of the kingdom of God, but only the one who can accept this should accept it. And in Jesus doing this, he's doing something fantastic. Because in his day, eunuchs were despised. They were considered on the same level or lower than, and sorry, this is just Jewish culture, women and children. They didn't seem to have any value. They couldn't perpetuate their line. They were seen as just despised and the lowest of the low. And yet Jesus says, you know what? No matter how you practice this and how you became a eunuch, you're welcome in the kingdom. It's not just married folk that I'm addressing in relation to divorce and remarriage. He's addressing those who are single, either by choice or by circumstance. And then, and we'll look at this next week, he then brings in the children. The little children were brought to Jesus to place his hands on them and pray for them, but the disciples rebuked those who brought them, and Jesus said, "Let the little children come to me." Also on the lowest category. And Jesus now is saying, married couples, singles by choice or circumstance, children, everyone, welcome in this kingdom. Everyone's a part of it. He's addressing about every different relationship stance you can have, and he's giving certain amounts of instruction on it, but for the most part, inviting people to be part of his kingdom. So that ends our reading, and we'll look more closely at the little children part, because that really needs some tweaking out. I want to bring us to some reflections, though, before we open up for some Q&A. If you, in our modern day, attempt to answer the question, what are reasons or are there reasons for divorce, you will fall into the same quagmire of challenge, that controversy that Jesus was in. You will. And one of the challenges you'll have early on is to come to your opinion, hopefully as based as much on Scripture as you can, but come to that opinion and know whatever opinion you have on divorce and remarriage, there are plenty of good Christians which will oppose you and say that's just not what the Bible teaches. There are at least four views, and so Jesus had these two views to deal with. In our modern day, you have at least four major views, and here they are. So you can see if you know someone were to come in here and do like the Pharisees and try to give me a gotcha question, they could be looking for a certain answer, and it might be one of these four. There are some Christians that say there's no reason at all. No legitimate reason whatsoever. So that once you've married, there could never be divorce. It's always wrong. It's always bad. You cannot do it no matter what. So, you have that perspective. The problem with that perspective is Jesus gives at least one exception and Paul gives at least one exception. But you do have people that will write off those exceptions or come up with very creative ways to do that. Then you have the view that, well, you can divorce, but you can never remarry. Roman Catholics, if you were married, you cannot divorce and remarry and ever receive communion unless that first marriage is annulled. Which is to say, it never really happened. Which I think that's wonderful magic. I wish I could do that with so many things in my life. Just, you know, annul your 18th through 22nd year. I mean, it just never really happened. But you can't, you know, that to me is some hocus pocus. I just don't know how you pull that off. But that's the idea behind it, is this union is so sacred. The bond, that you can't break it, so you just have to say it was never there in the first place. And that's what some will teach, but here's why I told you to pay very close attention to verse 9. I tell you that anyone who divorces his wife except for marital faithfulness and marries another commits adultery. Let's take the exception out of that and read it. I tell you that anyone who divorces his wife and marries another woman commits adultery except for marital unfaithfulness. So that exception clause is there to say that marriage and divorce, by default, breaks that bond. That bond is over. You have the right and the privilege to remarry if you so choose. Because that's the exception Jesus is going to give, and that exception includes the privilege or right of remarriage. The third view is the one I just taught you. It is to say divorce and remarriage are permittable at least in light of these two exceptions, when there's an infidelity that breaks the marriage covenant. Now, that doesn't mean you have to. There are many marriages that have worked through infidelity, and you know there's been great forgiveness and healing and therapy and all that, and they come out on the other end. That's why it's not a command. Jesus says Moses permitted. And then there is abandonment, which if someone abandons, you're pretty much stuck in the cold. It's impossible to make this marriage work when it's just one person. And then there's the fourth reason, which really to me is just a modification of the third. And I actually hold the fourth reason. I'll just throw out my cookies on the table. And that is divorce and remarriage for a variety of reasons. Because just because you give a command doesn't mean you have to mention every exception every time you say it. I'll be at your house on Tuesday. I don't have to tell you. Tuesday, unless I have another appointment, or unless my kids really, or unless my wife's sick, or unless, I mean, you just don't, that's not how the world works. We don't always have to throw out every exception with every command. And I think that thing called adultery is a pretty narrow, you know exactly what that is when you see it. But desertion is a wide field. The Puritans would actually teach that, well, I won't say what the Puritans teach because it would make you all mad. But they had this very wide view of desertion, and many people see them as prudes and very conservative. They would say that if your partner just refused in any way to show any affection or have any relations with you, that's desertion. They've deserted their commitment to be one flesh with you. So you have desertion, and that, of course, includes things like abuse. And it includes things like cruelty, and it includes things like addiction. Because when those things are there, you basically have checked out, even though you haven't checked out. So I think that those have to be included under that broad heading of desertion. And that's why I think adultery and desertion are the two specific scriptural reasons. But that opens us up to a number of others that come under those headings. What is not allowed when you use Jesus' way of coming at this in going back to original creation and looking at these exceptions because of our hardness of heart is polygamy. There's a couple there. And I would even include polyamory, which is really big in our culture right now. And 20 or 40 years from now, the big fight that pastors in my shoes will be facing is, what do you tell your congregation where people have consensually decided that they're going to have sexual relationships with numbers of people that they know, and it's all consensual, and they'll still be committed in marriage, but they're going to be having all these other relations on the side? It's called polyamory. Our UCC did a devotion on it where one guy in Chicago came out against it, and there were a lot of comments saying, who are you to judge? And I thought, wow, man, you know, you don't, what do you do? because this poor guy was getting eggs thrown at him for just simply saying, you know, if you're married to your partner, you probably ought to just have sex with your partner. But maybe I'm a prude. I don't know. So, it is to say that these are the major categories. Whatever you hold, you'll have to hold in your conscience. Hopefully you'll hold it with a matter of compassion and sympathy for others. Hopefully you'll never get in a place where you look down on those who have been through divorce and have experienced remarriage, because, quite frankly, nobody goes into that willingly. It's never something anyone says, "Woo, that divorce was awesome. You know, that was fantastic." Even losing a spouse that was a very difficult spouse to live with leaves an empty, gaping hole in your life. Which is why people go back to abusive relationships all the time. Because even if it was a bad relationship, at least it was a relationship. And so it's a very challenging thing. We don't want to walk over people's hearts in this, but we do want to have some kind of biblical standard by which we come at this, so that you can't divorce like the Pharisees want to say, for any and every reason. If someone came to my office and said, "I'm divorcing my wife because this girl's prettier," I'd say, "You are a loser." If someone came into my office and said, "I'm divorcing her because she just can't cook," I'd say, "Learn to cook yourself, loser." I mean, you see what I'm saying? It just doesn't become any and every reason. And that last one is not any and every reason. It is understanding desertion in a more broad way than just simply someone abandoning. Which is then to bring us to my final reflection, which I think is one of the neatest parts about this text. The neatest thing about this is not so much the divorce and marriage discussion, although that has some very interesting components. It is that for Jesus' way of understanding the sacred story, law is secondary. Law was something given because of sin. And in doing that, he's sounding a lot like Paul, isn't he? You know, law was given because of sin. And so, for him, law still is holy. It's still good. At least God regulates. At least God is trying to guide us and keep us on the straight and narrow. But law itself is never the solution. Law just regulates behavior and tries to keep us from causing that behavior to veer off in a way that causes the most harm. What we need is something much clearer to guide us in our understanding of God's will. And one of the best things is what Jesus is pointing out here. Reformed theologians call these the creation ordinances. That before the law is ever given, before any Sabbath command is given, hundreds or thousands of years later, in Genesis 2, Sabbath. And isn't it interesting, throughout cultures around the world, there's this sense of seven. And there's this sense of, you know, one in seven, you ought at least have some kind of break. And there's a sense that leisure and enjoying creation and reveling in it and valuing play and not having to constantly produce is something that brings joy. So that you have these Sabbath commands, which include worship and leisure from the beginning, before there's any hindrance or hint of sin. In Genesis 2, Adam is involved in meaningful labor. He's doing something that's making something of this world. And we all know that if you lose a sense of meaningfully doing something in this world, making something of this world, you start losing a will to live. Because that's part and parcel of what it means to be a creature of God, made for Sabbath and rest and leisure, but not just for leisure, but for meaningful work. Work that produces. We also know this, marriage, and Jesus has already brought that up, which is given because it's not good for the man to be alone. Which is to say, these meaningful relationships. So I don't think it's just exclusive to marriage, but this idea that relationships are what cause us to thrive and to be built up and to grow, to love others as we're being loved by God and as we love God through Sabbath worship and as we labor for our sakes and for their sakes, there's this wonderful sense of meaningfully knowing others while knowing God. And ultimately, when you go to that creation order, in Genesis 2, God is interacting with Adam. And after they fall into sin, the first couple, we read that while God was walking in the garden, "Adam, where are you?" And you get this sense of walking with God, which is why the heart is made for thee, and it's restless until it finds rest in thee. I would argue that when you take these creation ordinances, you see the law below the law. You see the pattern and the structures behind which all these other laws are going to try to regulate our behavior so that all of these things remain in the position that they ought to be, held with sanctity and dignity and a sense of being what it means to be a person living a meaningful, valuable, fulfilling, and satisfying life in this world, that we have a deep sense of walking with God, a deep sense of being loved and loved by others, a deep sense of meaningful labor, and a deep sense of knowing we can just rejoice and celebrate and just love what it means to be caught up in the good creation of God. When we come to the end of the book, I saw a new heaven and new earth. What happens is all of these things are brought forward again, but they're all intensified and transformed. They're not changed as much as they are intensified and brought to their highest level. And so that, for me, is what's most interesting about this text. Jesus' hermeneutic sees those first two or three chapters as setting the pattern by which God intended the world to be, so that we can understand how broken it is through human sin and why, sadly, there are need for laws at times to regulate our hard-hearted behavior to get us back in line. All right, that's our passage. Questions, comments, thoughts? We got 5 minutes. Worship team, why don't you come on up? Because we don't have as much time as I thought we'd have, but we have just a little bit of time. Lori over here has got her hand up, and Joe's right beside you, Lori. I think in one sense you can. You know, love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, strength, and mind. Love your neighbors yourself. All of that. Unless you love me more than you love father and mother, you're not worthy to be called my disciple. So I think in one sense you can. In another sense, I think you can't. Because that idea of priority to me is too segmented and regimented. And I love others best when I'm loving, showing the love of God with them and through them, and also, you know, working within a context in which I'm giving and being a gift to them through meaningful labor and all of that. And I always find that 1, 2, 3 a little bit too nice and tight. That's just me, because I don't know how you work that, to be quite honest. I just don't know how that works. Because if you do put it in that order, God first, spouse second, whatever third, I think, well, there's no room for spouse because God's it. But if I understand them all as being part of this whole and they're all, you know, wrapped up in that, that makes more sense to me. Except, like I said, when you talk about love God with all your heart, soul, strength, and mind, that's the highest love, because that's the primary love. That's the love from which all those others should flow out. So, you know, my answer is yes and no. And it's depending on how you're thinking of things. I just know, practically speaking, I'm not a guy that can work with 1, 2, 3. Because when I start thinking like that, 2 and 3 go away very quickly. What's 2 and why? What, number 1? So I'd rather think of a whole. Good question. Other thoughts? I'm glad you're focusing on creation ordinances, because I hope that that was in some way helpful. I think it's interesting. Jesus has that interesting hermeneutic. Any other questions, thoughts, comments? I tell you, I was very, very hesitant to preach this, because I thought, you know, who wants to preach about this? But I hope it'll help in some way. I hope it gives some comfort and consolation and some guidance, and it helps us understand Christ better and who's welcome in His kingdom. Helps us understand the preeminence of marriage and the challenges that it has and the hard road that it offers, and yet the value and the preciousness of trying to preserve it as much as we possibly can, and not just saying any and every reason. Okay. If you don't have any more questions, I'm happy. Because this is a tough one. All right. So, next week we'll look at the passage about welcome the little children. Such an important passage. And we'll continue to go through this verse by verse. Until then, our worship team will lead us in song, and we will receive our prayer request.